The most interesting data point to me was that seed stage valuations, they did not go down from 21.
It's the part of the market that I think is the most interesting right now. And there's a couple different dynamics happening.
So you have this kind of hot take of you think there's going to be some kind of reckoning on all these safes.
The complexity of these safes is pretty overwhelming at sometimes. We are hearing from some VCs that they're worried that founders don't understand safes well enough and they're giving up too much of their companies.
So do you actually think there's as much dry powder as the headline numbers might say?
My take is no, it's not real. Especially, let's maybe back up.
Emerging manager landscape, what are you seeing in the data?
Fundraising is much slower in 2023 for emerging managers, fewer funds being started.
Repricing of options was also up like 3 to 5x.
Effectively, repricing is founders and boards giving employees more upside in their equity. It's more frequent than it used to be. Most of that is happening at the late stage.
Historically, your entire time looking at all the data on the platform, what are the most surprising data points?
I think there are probably two interesting data points for early stage founders. One of the things that we found is that...
I think it's just better, like get in before a bubble. Invest in the next bubble before it's a bubble.
It sounds easy. Why don't we just do that?
I mean, you're the data guy. Are you seeing any new bubbles emerging?
New bubbles. I mean...
Welcome to The Peel, where we explore the world's greatest startup stories. I'm your host, Turner Novak, founder of Nana Capital. And today I'm bringing you a special episode. I'm sitting down with my friend, Peter Walker. Peter is the head of insights at Carta and writes a newsletter called The Data Minute, a weekly newsletter highlighting data from over 43,000 private tech companies that use Carta's platform to manage their cap table. Touching this many startups means Carta sees everything. And we talk through its recently republished Q4 2023 State of Private Markets report. We talk valuation trends across stages, why seed valuations have gone up over the past 2 years, despite the rest of the market being down significantly, the difference between AI and non-AI company fundraising rounds, and why Peter thinks biotech may be the next big bubble. We also get into how safes work, why Peter thinks there's a coming safe reckoning, how down rounds were twice as common in 2023 as historically, why half of all Series A's in 2023 were extensions, and my rationale on why startups don't pay dividends. We also talk through Peter's thoughts on the emerging manager fundraising landscape, why there's not as much dry powder as you might think, how an exit at seed can make a founder more money than at Series B, why it's most common to be acquired before raising a Series B, how the total number of startup employees shrunk in 2023, and why startup employees aren't exercising their options right now. This is an awesome conversation, all driven by data. And if you're watching video, you'll see all the charts up on the screen while we talk so you can follow along. Before we get started, a quick shout out to Samuel Shaw and John Richtigar for suggesting topics for the episode. Let's talk to Peter after a quick word from Atio. Regular listeners of the show have already heard me talk about Atio in the past. It's the powerful, intuitive, and easy to configure CRM built for today's modern company. It's flexible, easily configures to your unique data structures, and works for any go-to-market motion, from self-serve to sales-led. It automatically syncs and enriches your contacts, emails, and calendar, creates custom and powerful reports, and quickly builds Zapier-like automations all within the interface. Atio has built a truly elegant product, and people on Twitter are describing it as the linear of CRMs, which that is very high praise. The next era of companies deserves more than a one-size-fits-all CRM with an outdated user experience. Join OpenAI, Replicate, 11 Labs, and more. Try Atio instantly at atio.com, that's ATTIO.com, or if you want to support the show, visit through the link in the show notes and scale your company to the next level. Thank you, Atio, and now let's jump in. Peter, how's it going?
Turner, happy to be here, man.
Yeah, welcome to the show. So I wanted to kind of start things off. You work for Carta, you're the head, what's your official title?
Head of Insights.
Head of Insights. You have this very interesting, insightful newsletter that people should definitely subscribe to. We'll throw a link in the show notes.
Thank you.
And I mean, you do this like a couple times a week, just LinkedIn, Twitter, you throw out data, you create insights out of the data that you're seeing on the platform.
It's like once a week for the newsletter and then probably an extra 3 or so graphics on social, primarily LinkedIn. So a lot of data being slung around.
I think it's a couple weeks old at this point, but still pretty fresh. The Q4 market report that you put out, just based on all the data that you're seeing. I thought it'd be really fun to just kind of talk through what you're seeing, objective, subjective, a little bit of opinion. So kind of the first big one was valuations. What were you seeing just broadly in terms of valuations on the Carta platform?
So across Carta, obviously there's different trends depending on what stage of company you're looking at, but valuations are sort of ticking back up after hitting a recent low in the middle of 2023. Basically across the board, there's something a little weird happening with Series C that seems to still be trundling along at the bottom, but seed, Series A, those are trending upwards in valuation. And then late stage, which has been the worst hit part of the venture market, also up, you know, pretty sizably on low volume of rounds, but the valuations seem to be trending back up. We're not close on the late stage to 2021 boom times, but at least we're not continuing to head downward.
Yeah, we probably shouldn't be back to the boom times.
No, like, I mean, that's, yeah, I don't, it's not like a worthy goal to say we need to eclipse 2021.
Yeah, that's super. I didn't even notice that Series C had not picked back up when I looked at it the other day.
It may just be noise. You know, it's one quarter. It's probably a few hundred rounds. Like it, you know, there can be statistical noise in there, but it does seem as though the jump, like getting from, say, seed Series A is its own little world. Series B, Series C, you're really talking about companies that probably raised their Series A in 21 and like, or maybe even 20. And so like, that's a, like that transition is very difficult right now.
Yeah. I think this is a, you know, overly descriptive. It's not always true in every case, but generally when you're raising an A, the business model isn't 100% proven out just on average. And when you're raising a Series C or a Series D, you're usually profitable. Like there are business lines, you're probably investing a lot in new products and features, but the core business probably makes money. So to your point of if you raise an A or a B in 21, that was stretched a little bit even more, all those cases. So if you're going for your C, it's like, you know, you're probably going to make some adjustments downward, I would assume.
It's one of those things where if you're, you know, if you're coming into company maturity sort of in the boom times and you think that, hey, we have a model that gets us close to profitability or is, you know, we're making a lot of money on, and then interest rates change, everything changes. Like it kind of is harder if you've already committed to that economic model to switch it. If you find out, hey, there's actually not as many customers willing to pay for this as we assumed. So the middle part of the market is like really challenging.
It's probably even more challenged from some of the changes we're seeing in the landscape of just like AI layoffs, that kind of stuff, changing profitability, also changing like velocity of product adoption and size of ACVs, like contracts that people are signing. I mean, there's a lot that's kind of been thrown out the window and changed in the last 2 years.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a totally new environment, basically, that these companies have to grow up in.
Probably the most interesting data point in the data to me was that seed stage valuations did not go down, basically, from 21. I think we'll throw the chart up, but I believe over the last 2 years, maybe it's 24, 18 months, but seed stage valuations are up like 40% or 20%, 40%.
Yeah, from where they were in Q1 21, which everyone would point to as like a very good quarter. Turner, it's the part of the market that I think is the most interesting right now. And there's a couple different dynamics happening. One is, you know, funds and especially bigger funds moving down market, which if your minimum check size is increased from whatever the standard historical has been for seed, it sort of puts a floor under valuations. You really can't invest into companies at a very tiny valuation. And we're talking about priced seed rounds here for the moment. And then the other dynamic is safes, like companies raising multiple safe rounds before they get to priced equity, which used to be very uncommon and is now, you know, people do it all the time. That in itself, because a lot of those safes are post money, so they guarantee a percentage ownership, it again pushes up the valuations when they get to their first price round. So I don't see a dynamic where priced seed can go that much lower. Like there's a lot of floors underneath those valuations, like regardless of you're even talking about the intrinsic value of these companies.
Yeah, I think the other thing I see too is all these markets are just supply demand. The price just settles at like the supply of capital or demand of capital and supply or demand of founders. And you meet wherever the market wants to clear at.
And I think one thing that's happening is if you're thinking about pricing around and money being transacted, I think when it comes to hiding earlier, I think a lot of funds are actually hiding in more consensus founders also. So instead of me, who's probably not a consensus founder, going out and raising money and probably at a lower valuation, it's somebody who worked at Google doing AI research and now they're starting an AI company. And that's, you know, it's fairly consensus. They're going to get a higher valuation. So the money just doesn't clear at the low end of the market, bringing the average higher.
I think that's definitely happening. Like, people are rotating towards repeat founders even more than they ever have been, which explains a little bit, you know, we have some other data released late last year about the demographics of founders. And there was this steady sort of more equitable split between, you know, underrepresented minority founders and women founders, et cetera. Like, those percentages were climbing slowly, but climbing. And then they all sort of, as a group, turned down last year. You know, the percentage of women founders fell, the percentage of funding that going to Black founders fell, et cetera. And I think part of what's happening is that the rotation towards repeat founders, if you're a repeat founder, by default, you were starting your company 5-6 years ago, and you were probably less diverse as a cohort than the people that are founding companies now. So it's a bit of a shame, but that is one of the dynamics that happens when, like, this downturn kind of flows through.
Yeah, I think another thing I'm seeing is, I mean, it's basically just people taking less risk, and the market perceives that as being riskier. Whether that's true or not, that's what the market thinks. And I've seen the same thing with certain categories and then also certain markets, like geographies. So I made a couple investments internationally in markets like Nigeria, India, Pakistan, Vietnam. If you're a VC and you're, you know, you kind of got in trouble investing in crypto, your valuations were too high, and you're trying to course correct, right? You're like, all right, I'm investing in the most consensus founder that matches the stereotype. And I'm also investing in SaaS or AI versus, you know, Vietnam. Like, has there ever been a Series B raised in Vietnam? Like, I don't know. Of course there has, but it's just, you're less likely to do it. You're going to do the things that are just more down the fairway because we don't want to take risks right now. That's generally the consensus, because risk capital is very, very scarce.
Yeah, totally agree.
Have you seen anything interesting in terms of sector dispersion, like AI versus non-AI?
Yeah, I mean, AI, certainly the story of last year. A lot of, if you're looking for, like, where did the growth go in venture as everything was coming down in 23, AI was the category that grew. But we also saw, I thought, like, not gigantic, but meaningful shift in some ways away from standard core software businesses in all cases and towards more hard tech businesses. So biotech, medical devices, hardware, energy, things that, you know, building in atoms, not bits. There was, those industries typically relatively on a funding basis held up a little bit better than fintech, crypto, blah, blah, blah. And that, I think, is probably a good thing for the ecosystem as a whole. You know, it's great to be investing in places where the risk is technical instead of just execution. I don't know if that's going to hold for that long, but it seems as though that leveled out in some markets, which was, I thought that was pretty cool to see. Outside of the AI bubble, which is totally real.
You're saying the bubble is real or the tech is real?
I think the tech is real, but also if you look at valuations, the bubble is definitely real. I mean, Series A on the platform, I think median for 23 for non-AI was something like 39 million, whereas median for AI was 50 million on a pre-money basis. So the gap is real. AI founders are raising more money at higher valuations. That's definitely happening. Whether or not they will become better businesses, you know, we got to check back in 5 years.
That's actually lower than I would have expected. That's only like a 30% difference, something like that.
Yeah. I mean, we read about you read about the gigantic ones, but there's a lot of that is not, of course, people have had this debate of, you know, do you invest in wrappers or only core LLM models or whatever, you know, what stage of AI are you focused on? A lot of the AI investment that we're seeing is not into companies building their own models. It's into, you know, companies utilizing those models to, you know, achieve whatever they're trying to do faster.
And I guess you're also not capturing the, like, revenue multiple. You're just the headline valuation number.
Correct. Yeah, we don't know whether or not those AI companies are getting a much higher multiple than the non-AI ones. I would assume there's definitely some gap there. But I mean, maybe you would know better than I would when you go into AI deals.
Yeah, I mean, I don't invest in very many, but it's, I mean, like double, I would say, just at least, probably more.
What's your thesis on not investing in AI, or maybe not investing, but doing it slowly?
Yeah, I mean, I think the only thing you can really control is a private market investor as your entry point. It's so hard to control the exit. So if you invest at a high multiple, you need to probably sell at a higher multiple. And like, it's just really hard when you said earlier, like objectively, you are in an AI bubble. It's usually not good, just broadly speaking, to invest at the top of a bubble. So it's really the only thing I can control is an investor. Like, I mean, I can influence what I invest in. Like, I can control that, make my own decisions. And I cannot influence really like how big the outcome is, when it is. The only thing I really have control of is how low my entry price is when I can come in. And just generally speaking, if you want to have lower entry prices, you probably need to avoid whatever the current thing is, whatever the bubble is, as hard as that is to do.
So you're heavy in crypto is what you're saying.
I wish. I didn't do it fast enough. Yeah. I feel like we're just getting into these bubbles faster and faster. Like they inflate faster than ever.
I totally agree. I think there is something meaningful to the speed of like the trend changes. You know, I like AI, we've done this since ChatGPT came out in November 22. So it's been, a year plus, and people are already looking for the next thing or calling it a bubble. Like, I do think that you're moving through these cycles faster and faster.
Yeah. And I feel like we were already in the bubble in February of 23. Like I don't really use this term ChatGPT wrapper a lot, because I think really when you think about it, Riverside that we're using is an AWS wrapper. Like you're probably listening to this on Spotify or YouTube or Apple Podcasts, and they use the cloud. Like they use AWS, like
RSS wrappers.
Yeah. So, but there were some of these basically just like a clone of ChatGPT, like exactly the same thing that were, in my opinion, were getting a little bit too much funding thrown at them. So it's pretty fascinating, just in my opinion, just the speed that it all came at. I think it's just better, like, get in before a bubble, invest in the next bubble before it's a bubble. Like, that's
right. Yeah, it sounds easy. Why don't we just do that? Like,
I mean, you're the data guy. Tell me what's like the next, are you seeing any new bubbles emerging?
New bubbles. I mean, if you talk to the folks at the Gundo, you know, the bubble is hardware. The bubble is building real tech. I don't know if I'm seeing anything on the level of AI. I do think that there's going to be, like, I thought this one of, if not the strongest performers outside of AI was biotech for across the last 2 years. Like biotech, both in terms of the actual investment and in terms of the ecosystems that are anchored in biotech, specifically like Boston and San Diego, like just held up relatively better. Maybe it's because the cycles in venture capital work a little different in biotech than they do in other places, but that's been a bright spot. So if you're looking for a real prediction, you know, biotech, I think, is a great place to be.
In the sense of we're going into a biotech bubble, or like,
oh, I don't, I mean, I hope it doesn't get to bubble status. Look, we just spoke about maybe the trends moving more quickly. Like, will anything knock off AI as the top story from this year? I don't see it yet, but maybe crypto's back. You know, maybe there's something else that's just around the corner and we need to be all Bitcoin maxis again.
Yeah, I mean, I think Bitcoin is at all-time high, and it feels like it has not had the same collective consciousness as it did the last time. So,
which is probably a good thing overall for Bitcoin, right?
Yeah, I mean, my prescription, if we're just thinking about supply demand, like there could be more demand for this bubble to keep going up if we want to prescribe it in that sense. So, well, yeah, and I think I remember one of the things I wanted to hit on was it looks like Boston passed New York. New York City is number two overall. I think it was dollars raised ecosystem. Is that showed up in the data in 2023?
It did. Again, probably because of that anchor. So Boston had more dollars invested into Boston companies headquartered in Boston than New York companies headquartered in New York last year on Carta, but many more rounds happening in New York. So just on average, the Boston rounds were bigger, mostly because a lot of those early stage biotech rounds are bigger than the early stage SaaS ones. That's one of the reasons. But Boston, I don't think Boston gets the love that it deserves as a really, really mature venture ecosystem. It's the only thing that has a chance of really challenging New York and San Francisco for the long term, at least in my view. I don't think, you know, LA is just a big place. So like the total numbers are pretty big, but it doesn't have the same sort of gravity that a place like Boston does. And I think Boston, the cool part about Boston is it used to be just a biotech story. And now they've got, you know, a lot of founders doing SaaS AI, health tech. Like there's a lot of adjacent things that are coming out of Boston. So good, relatively a really good year for Boston in our data.
Yeah. And if you just think VCs love funding things that match certain patterns, you've got Harvard and MIT right there. It's one of their favorite patterns to match for. So, and then it looks like just in the sense of deal count. So I'm just reading this. Startups closed 462 seed investments or seed rounds in Q4, which was the lowest amount since Q1 of 2018, which is down 27% year over year. That kind of supports my thesis of there's just fewer rounds clearing and happening. So that could be why we're seeing valuations tick up. It's just there's less seed rounds closing.
Agreed. The only caveat there is that count, 462, is of priced seed rounds. So when you throw in safes, which are just a much bigger deal than they were in 2018, like big, big safe rounds, you get a little bit closer. The dynamics with safes, I think, are really, they're pretty fascinating. It's become the default way to fund early stage companies, but it's just like eating more and more into where price rounds used to be. And so it makes some of this a little bit more obscure if you don't have access to like the safe underlying safe data.
And you guys do not, it's only the priced equity rounds.
No, we do. I think actually we may be the only source of data in the States that has really good information on safes and convertible notes because they're run through the platform. And, you know, if Carta companies are raising on safes, it's like a 6-click process to send out a safe. So that's something I've been digging into a lot more. And it's just people are using them all the time. Even people that have already raised priced rounds, like we see more safes popping up in between seed and series A or series A and series B, which seems odd to me. It seems like a weird use of that instrument. But, you know, I guess people are trying to get capital in any way they can.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of just a quick way to do an extension. Like I need to raise $1 million. We're just going to do the same terms. Or maybe we just say, hey, we did the last round at 20 million and we made all this progress and we're doing this one at 25. Like you're probably getting it. Maybe you're getting a deal, but maybe like the multiple of whatever you're investing in on goes down. Like this is like 20 is not fair anymore, but 25 is fair. And you just want to send us the 500 grand right now and we'll just do a save and we don't have to go through this whole legal thing. Like maybe it's follow on for someone. Maybe it's like somebody who couldn't get in to the last round or didn't have their fund raised or something. And the safe is just, you know, for people who don't know what a safe is, it is a simple agreement for future equity, which basically says everyone agrees when you do the whole legal work for an official round, they'll get their shares. And it's kind of a agreement that everyone sticks to say that you'll get your shares when you go through the process, because it's a long process, it's kind of expensive. And a safe, you can do it for free. Like there's literally templates online. If you Google safe template as a founder or go to Carta.
I you're totally right. The value, like it's the easiest, and even convertible notes too, and in between price rounds are pretty common is, hey, we want to do some sort of extension or bridge. Like we'll do it on a convertible or a safe instead of a price round. The only difficulty that I see with that is that like those are going to come due sometime, right? So like if you're doing a lot of those in between price rounds, like at some point, the signal is like, why can't you just raise your B or like whatever it is? And that gets kind of tricky.
And so you have this kind of hot take of you think there's going to be a little bit of a, I don't know, backlash is the right word, but some kind of reckoning on all these saves. What do you mean by that?
So in two forms, at the early stages, we are hearing from some VCs, not all of them, but enough that it's become a little bit of a trend that they're like, worried that founders don't understand safes well enough and they're giving up too much of their companies. So they're, you know, you raise a safe round at a specific valuation cap, maybe you get a 500K in the door, and then you raise another one for $1 million that's at a slightly higher valuation cap. And then you might even raise another one for a slightly higher valuation cap. And all of these, if they're post money, they like guarantee a percentage ownership of the company once you raise that price round. And then they come to the price round and they're like, wow, I own less of this company than I thought. The complexity of these safes is like pretty overwhelming at sometimes. So that's one. And then I guess the more interesting take from my perspective is, okay, there's a story out there in venture that says there's going to be a lot of companies powered by AI that will come out and raise a little bit of capital, $1 to $5 million, and then just never raise again. They'll get to profitability and then that's it. If they do it on safes, there's no automatic conversion for those safes into equity. I mean, you know, probably there will be because it's a conversation with your investors, but there's no, in the standard docs, there's no reason why that ever has to become real equity. So I think using safes to just do the tiny funding and then never take funding again is actually like a bit of a different use of them. And I'm not sure it works completely.
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't know the nuance of this, but I've gotten money back when companies have been acquired and I've had a save. I know I've gotten paid for that. But yeah, I'm super curious, actually, like the technical.
I guess the question for me is, are you seeing a lot of founders coming to you these days that say, we want to take $1 million to $3 million and then our goal is to never raise funding again?
I've seen elements of that, yeah. I've also seen one really interesting one. They wanted to pay dividends. Like it was, we think this is going to be super profitable and we're just going to pay you like 10% of your investment in dividends every year. Also, in addition to like continuing to increase the valuation. But I mean, there's two issues with that. I think one is generally, if you're a startup, your ROI or rate of return from building products is probably higher than the 10% return that I'm getting from a dividend. So I almost feel like it's a waste of capital to be giving me my 10% returns when you could be building a company that generates 20, 30, 40, 100% returns. That's kind of one element of it. But then I think another element is, if you just keep giving me these dividends, like there's tax implications for my investors. And then also I have to like do stuff with the capital that I get back. And most venture firms there, they get that stuff, but it's not like a core part of the strategy of getting these dividends back. It's just most aren't set up for that. So it will just take a little bit of more education and understanding from all parts of the market for that to be thing. But that was a really interesting one that, and these guys, like it was a really good idea. Really strong founders, and they actually listen to the podcast. So maybe he'll shoot me an email after he listens to this. But it was a super, super interesting concept of, you know, we are intentionally planning on paying out dividends for, you know, foreseeable future. Like it's going to probably be part of the strategy.
I think there's going to be a lot of, on the edges at least, maybe not in the majority of cases, but people sort of experimenting with, what does fundraising look like? What does payout look like? Like there's no reason why what the docs that we have today and the standard way we do it has to continue to be the way that it's done. You know, there's 500 Global has this KISS sort of standard talk document that's like a twist on a safe. So like there's a lot of people trying different things, but just as fundamentally people take, I think capital usually flows through the most convenient routes. So just because the safe is the easiest and the cheapest, it will continue to garner a lot of the initial fundraising until something else comes along and displaces it.
That's fair. And speaking of safes and like extensions and bridge rounds, I saw in the data, there's a chart, I believe for each quarter in 2023, this isn't just Q4, this is all year. Basically down rounds were about 19 or 20% of all funding rounds each quarter. And that was, I have to pull it up again, but it looks like it was about roughly double-ish historical averages, maybe just below double. What are you seeing there on all these down rounds?
Yeah, so down rounds, you got it exactly right. It's about 2x what it usually is, which is about 10% of rounds, higher the later stages. But even at the early stages, you know, down rounds still becoming more common. I guess two ways to think about that. One is down rounds suck. That's pretty obvious. But two is that at least in the down round, there's like an agreement between the founders and investors that, hey, we got overvalued in the boom time. That's okay. We can take our valuation down. This business is still a really good, viable business. It just isn't worth that right now. I think that's a silver lining. Like that, it speaks well to those people that are taking the down rounds and moving forward. You get into some really tricky territory if you're trying to avoid the down round at all cost and you take on terms that are really, really investor favorable, or there's cram down, like recaps. There's a whole lot of messy stuff that can happen. So like a clean down round is actually maybe preferable in some cases to like messy, messy flat rounds.
And I think there's almost this avoidance of down rounds. Like people don't want to do them, but it's, if you just look at generally like the stock market that shows daily valuations of thousands of companies, no stock just goes up into perpetuity. Like,
right. Unless you're Jensen, but like, even then he's a couple years in the wilderness.
Yeah. I mean, he's done some public market down rounds. Like if you look at the stock chart in Nvidia, and then even like Facebook did a big down round when they were a massive company. It was like $10 billion valuation. They did a down round at that price. And it is one of the most well-positioned companies in the world right now. One of the best cash flowing businesses ever.
It's a weird, like, just fact of life that down rounds just hold way more stigma in private than they do in public. Now, some of that is because information in the public market is so much more opaque in the first place. And it's just like, a lot of this is signal. So it's like, oh, you took a down round that might scare off investors for the future or whatever it is. You also have to do a lot of explaining to your investors and then also to your employees about what does this mean? How does this impact their valuations? So it's definitely not easy. But if there was a way for venture to become, for the down round to be less stigmatized than venture, I think it would be very healthy.
I think too, part of it is, a lot of it is attracting talent and getting smart people. And your compensation is, you're going to get a lot in stock. So it can be tricky when you're like, hey, we've done our last two rounds were both down rounds. It doesn't trend well. I mean, the human brain sees the Nvidia stock price and says, I got to get in on this. It looks great. Right. So you, in the opposite, I don't know what's a stock that's down right now, Expensify or something. Their stock down quite a bit. I think if you're just looking solely at the stock price and you're making an employment decision and you get compensated quite a bit, like if you get granted your stock and it's worth 100,000 and the stock goes up 5x, you actually got 500 grand instead of 100, and you got a really good, you know, deal on your compensation, the way that you earn money, save for your family, you know, save up to start a new company. Like, it's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, huge deal.
And another thing too, on bridge rounds, I saw that 45% of Series A's were actually bridge rounds or extension Series A's. That's a pretty big number. And that's, I think, the highest in your data set ever historically of any round.
It's wild. It just points to the dynamic that we've been hearing from investors all year, which is, I am spending a lot of time with my current portfolio companies. Most of them are asking me for more cash, and I'm having to choose amongst all of these, you know, company children that I have. You know, if I have 20 investments and all 20 are asking for more cash, I can only double down on 3, maybe 4. And so the question is, which I don't think our data can answer, but maybe you have more perspective on this. Are they doubling down on the best companies? Are they saying, look, we want to do a preemptive bridge because we really like it, we want to shore up our ownership percentage or whatever it is? Or are they doubling down on the companies that are, you know, we think a little bit more cash can keep them alive for a little longer? We don't have a ton of hope, but like, maybe it's a good use of cash right now. I can't really suss out which is which.
Yeah, I think it's both. I think the keep it alive, quote unquote, it's probably more of, it's not 100% working, but there are signs. Like, they did sign a pretty big contract, and we think they can continue to sign larger contracts where this starts to get interesting again. Or they're on the finish line and they have 3 months of runway, and we just know if we give them, you know, 5-6 more months, they'll close a couple more of these big contracts and they'll be able to raise the next round, kind of a thing. I've seen that a couple times. I think there's definitely an element of like doubling, tripling down, just giving more money to winners. I mean, that's like a classic VC thing. It's like, you know, you're the founder, I'm your board member, and we're talking, and I'm just like, man, Peter's crushing it. I just got to give him more money because someone else is going to find out about this. I got to put more money in this thing. Like, that's the way a lot of VCs think about it. I've seen it with some of my portfolio companies where they will kind of take a small early round from someone that they don't classify it as a Series A or a Series B, but it's like a seed extension or a Series A extension that has a new outside investor, and we don't label it a new round. Because that investor kind of sees how things are inflecting, and, you know, in 3 months it's going to look really good, but they'll probably pay a higher price. So they just come in today, and it's, you know, $6 million seed extension instead of a Series A, or a $12 million Series A in 4 months or whatever. I see that trade-off happening a little bit too.
To your point, like it's not as though bridges are always bad, right? Bridges are extensions. They can be good. They could be signs that, yeah, as you said, the next primary round investor is like super excited and wants to get in a little bit early. So that 45% isn't all negative. But historically, when you look at early stage rounds, it's something like 25% are bridges, 25 to 30. So the jump is indicative of a lot of companies that are saying, we need more cash. We need more cash. And we are going to the same people, mostly, you know, the vast, vast majority of these bridge rounds are being done with participation from insiders on the cap. So that's, and we're talking about, you know, one of the things we maybe wanted to touch on was dry powder and like, where is it going? I think some of it is being funneled into those kinds of things.
So do you actually think there's as much dry powder as the headline numbers might say? Because I feel like that's kind of a meme, right? It's like, oh, VCs have raised whatever, like $1 trillion. It's ready to be deployed to startups. Like, is that true?
I mean, yeah, Andreessen's raising a $7 billion fund, like as we speak. My take is no, it's not real. Especially, let's maybe back up. It's not real for these individual founders. So there's not, I don't think that a founder can sit and go, look, there's going to be a deluge of capital that's coming in 6 months. I'm going to time my round to that. Like, that's not a good way to think about it. Where is the dry powder going? Well, one, it hasn't been called by the VCs, right? It's committed capital, but it's not called capital. So it's not sitting in VC bank accounts. It's still with the LPs in many cases. Those LPs, especially over the last year, and especially if they weren't institutions, I mean, you tell me, Turner, like, they seemed pretty fine with a slow deployment pace. You know, not having a capital call of $1 million if I'm a high net worth individual in 2023, that's a good thing, not a bad thing. So that's one, like it can always be slower and there can always be agreements between the VC and the LP about the pace of deployment. And then third, it's going into propping up current portfolio companies. It's going into safes and convertible notes that nobody can really see in bridges. Like it's going into different places. So I think in the end, is there a lot of dry powder? Sure, but it's not like some utopia that you can just wait for and it's just going to show up in venture.
Yeah, and I think a way to kind of crystallize what this dry powder means is if I'm an investor, I raise $1 billion fund. I don't get all the money right away. It's basically, Peter, if you're giving me $1 billion, we make an agreement of like, hey, you're on the hook for it when I want it. But we kind of have this mutual understanding of I'm not going to just invest it all right away. And I'll probably, historically, we would invest it over 3 years. But it got faster over the last decade where, I mean, everyone was making money. Prices were going up. So it was stupid of me to only be to invest over 3 years instead of, you know, 2.5 or 2 or 1.5 or 1. I mean, I think the fastest I saw was, this is just based on some like headline numbers in the press. I mean, people, there were a couple funds that deployed their entire fund in like 4 or 5 months. Crazy. And prices are going up, right? Like if I've got money to work, I should like rationally should be deploying. And a lot of the way that a lot of VCs make money is actually, there's this whole thing like 2 and 20. 2% management fees, you collect 2% of the fund size every year, and then you get 20% of the profits. You reach a certain point where it is in the 2% management fees, kind of a little bit of a tricky play on numbers because it's 2% a year for 10 years. So it's 20%. So if you raise $1 billion, you get $200 million in fees. That's a lot. So why don't you just go raise the next fund? Like all your valuations are going up and you're making money and you look good. Like deploy as fast as you can to raise the next $200 million in fees and then invest the next one faster. You can raise the next one.
Completely. There's like a, you know, VCs at different parts of the ecosystem are playing different games. You know, you're playing an AUM game where you're running on management fees and you're loving it. That's the, you know, that's basically where the big, big, big funds are now. Or you're an emerging manager and you're playing the 20% is the thing that you really care about. You need DPI. You need to show that you are a quality investor and you've picked quality companies. And then you've got to make sure you get it right. Because the other sort of sad thing is the, you know, how it's been difficult for founders to fundraise. It's been equally difficult for GPs to fundraise from LPs last year. And so there is inevitably over the next 2 or 3 years, there are going to be people who raise their first fund in 21 or 22 that just don't get to fund two. Or fund two that don't get to fund three. We've already seen it with OpenView returning capital. Like there's a lot of things going on where the suggestion is that there will be meaningfully fewer VC funds in 2 years than there are right now. And I think that's definitely going to happen.
Yeah, it's wild. I did my first close of my second fund in Q2 of 2022. It was that was a tough fundraise.
Very different experience than the first fund.
Yeah, I mean, the first one was too easy. The second fund was the right amount of hard. I mean, it was probably harder than it could have been, but I mean, it should not be easy to raise money. I think that when we kind of reflect on all this data, numbers are down, but they were artificially inflated because there's appetite for risky assets. And what is the riskiest possible investment you can think of? Tech startups that like are just getting started. Like there's this vision of we're going to change the world. We're going to be worth $1 trillion, but we're just starting the company now. I mean, that is pretty far on the, as far as you can get on the risk spectrum.
And if you're getting 5% or 6% on savings accounts, like it's a totally different world.
Well, so then when you talk about the emerging manager landscape, you kind of said it's going to be a lot trickier. What are you seeing in the data, just in some of the numbers?
Yeah, fundraising is much slower in 2023 for emerging managers, fewer funds being started as fund formations. And then there's it's a tricky moment. I feel as though VCs oftentimes are kind of at the mercy of opaqueness in data. Like, how are you going to go and prove to these LPs that you are the emerging manager they want to bet on? I mean, number one, if you have it, DPI is the best thing to show them. Like, look, I've returned capital to investors. A lot of funds started in the last 3 years obviously don't have that. So they're trying to figure out, how do I prove, like, what are the metrics, whether it's TVPI, net IRR, what is it that I can show these LPs? And a lot of times it like boils down to deployment pace. Like, did you sit out some of the craziness, or do you have an unfair advantage when it comes to sourcing founders? And like, those things are much more difficult to prove. So emerging managers are, you know, Andreessen's going to be fine. They're going to fundraise from the LPs that they already have, and it's going to be okay. And they're not really going to need to worry about it too much. That sourcing LPs has gotten much harder over the last year and a half for emerging managers who invest in different kinds of people. So we would love for the emerging manager landscape to be really healthy, because I think it broadens the amount of founders and the types of founders that actually get funding, but it's been hard.
Yeah, I think one way I kind of crystallize for people to understand the what an emerging manager might go through. So if we'll just say you're one of the really big funds, we'll say A16Z, because they're probably the largest in terms of employees that work there. All the different functions of the business, investor relations, so raising capital, there's a team, a lot of people that do that work on that full time. Portfolio support, have a lot of people that just spend their time helping portfolio companies with each task. There's like a team that does recruiting, a team that does go to market, a team that does insert any kind of value add. You have the deal teams, the people whose job is, you know, sourcing, hunting. There's people whose jobs are winning, people whose jobs are sitting on the boards. There's people whose jobs are marketing. So there's like each of these scaled platforms has like teams that do all these things. And when you're an emerging manager, you have to do all of those things that are normally done by a team yourself. So not just fundraising, like just how do you add value to your portfolio companies when you're competing against like somebody that has like 20 people that they're working with? It's tough.
Yeah. And like, will the, you know, there's been a retreat, I think. I don't love the word tourist. People use the word tourist too often, I think, in venture.
Yeah. It's kind of like a derogatory, humiliating type of like.
It's like, don't gatekeep that way. Like, it's cool to have people interested in the thing you're doing. You know, like, you don't have to be this pitchfork person who says, like, I found this band first, you know? But there is a dynamic, though, where you say, okay, tourist founders, like people who are excited about being founders in 21, maybe less excited about being founders in 23, kind of maybe the same thing for emerging managers. And certainly at the biggest end, the Tigers, the SoftBanks, like the big, big crossover funds are just way less interested in venture than they were 2 years ago. So does that mean that there's enough great founders for the VCs that remain? Maybe, but as you said, like, if you're a solo GP and you're taking on every single aspect of running a venture fund, when fundraising gets harder, it just makes everything else more difficult too. And maybe then you slow down your deployment pace because you're kind of like, I only get this one shot and I have to pick the right company. So I want to make sure that these are perfect ones. So that might also contribute to slower investment.
And then the consensus founders too. Like, am I going to pick, am I going to pick Peter Walker, or am I going to pick, you know, we'll say you're like blue chip, or am I going to pick some other guy that I'm meeting for the first time versus I've known Peter for a decade and know he's contributed all these things and he's exited a company before versus, you know, person I just met. So that definitely goes into it too. And it's not just the emerging managers, it's everyone. Everyone's kind of going slower on fundraising. So you mentioned something super interesting, the Tiger and the SoftBanks of the world. Those are probably the stereotypical raise large amounts of capital and influence the market. Have you looked much at like deal count by firm or like capital deployed by firm? Does that show up in your data?
We haven't really done a great analysis of that. We would have that information for the funds that are on the fund admin side of the platform, but we would need to do some work to aggregate it from the cap tables. It's true that like, I know for a fact there's just less involvement from big crossover funds than there were. But I think the shift that we talked about earlier is influencing things. Like if you set aside the late part of the market, which is its own beast, but the early part of the market, if you have $1 billion seed funds, like the checks have to be a certain size, right? Or you have like $500 million seed funds. You cannot invest $50,000 in these startups. It doesn't work for your fund economics to make sense. So that's where I think some of the influence of bigger funds is being seen, is that as people move earlier and earlier, the check sizes get bigger and the valuations cannot go below a certain floor.
Yeah. And I think a way to kind of crystallize that, if you're hearing this for the first time, is if you have a $1 billion portfolio that you have to invest over, we'll just say 3 years, that's kind of historical industry standards. If a founder comes to you and says, I'm looking for $1 million, that is 0.1% of the portfolio. Over a 3 year period, you would have to make a $1 million investment every day to invest that $1 billion pool of capital. There's a ton of nuance, and you're probably, if you have a $1 billion fund, you're probably reserving it over half for follow on. So then again, it's every 2 days, whatever. But then you have to actually like do the things related to post investment on making that $1 million investment. So it's really, really challenging to justify that versus we're just going to write a $20 million check. Like we'll just find the guy who sold his company to Salesforce is doing some new AI thing and we'll give him $20 million. And I'm buddies with them. We went to school together.
Right. We golfed together on the weekend. So like, of course, it's all good. Yeah.
So that definitely has influenced, I think, how some of these, some things show up in the data.
Yeah. I'm interested to see, you know, that actually was the selling point by some of these firms in 21. They were like, we're dumb capital. We're not going to talk to you. You're not going to need to talk to us. Here's a lot of money and go win. I don't know. Does that value pitch still work for founders? Maybe it was only really available to the late stage ones, but to me, it seems like probably not quite as useful these days.
Yeah, I think it's a compelling pitch, but you don't have to be a dumb capital fund to make that pitch. You can be the we're value add fund, but you can also say, oh, you don't want us to help you? Great. We'll do our value add somewhere else. So I just don't know how defensible that we're dumb capital pitch is.
Anyone with capital can make the dumb capital pitch. Yes.
I think the case would have to be we'll always overpay on valuation and we'll be right about it, which is like a pretty risky pitch. I don't know. It works when market's going up, but
yeah, it works when you're right.
Yeah. Well, okay. So when you're right, like making money, like the exit environment, what have you kind of seen just in terms of on the like on your, all of your data exits that are happening? How are those in 2023 and Q4?
I mean, obviously IPOs are few and far between. We had what, like 5 tech IPOs and the ones that did like Klaviyo and others didn't perform amazingly well last year. So the lack of IPOs is probably the biggest single factor impacting late stage valuations. There's no IPO. There's no way to price discover what the public markets really think about these companies. It gums up the works of late stage venture. So we need the IPO market back. Really, really hopeful that later this year, I'm not betting on the first half of 24, but you know, I would put a little bit of money on the idea that one or two major companies will IPO in the latter half of this year. It depends on interest rates. It depends on a lot of things, but hopefully that's the case. You know, public stocks are doing quite well right now, at least the big ones. The other way that exits happen, though, is M&A. Oftentimes, there was an idea that M&A was going to boom last year because valuations are falling. There's like a lot of these companies could be attractive if their valuations got more in line. It M&A was basically flat on Carta. It's about 150 companies are acquired off of the platform every quarter. That's a slightly down from 22, but basically flat quarter of, or year over year. So maybe this year will be a year of a lot of M&A. I think maybe, again, that's a little bit optimistic. Perhaps the reason that not a lot of M&A is happening is because people got under the hood of these companies and are like, well, this isn't like M&A is a difficult bet at the best of times. Like maybe this isn't where we want to be playing, but I'd expect some more acquisitions than last year. But exits, you know, you can't, as the saying goes in venture, like you can't eat CVPI. Like you cannot eat these metrics until they become real when you actually get an exit and actually return cash to people. And those have been far, far between.
Yeah, I think the sort of thing that I'm seeing is, why would you exit in 23 if it was a quote unquote down round bad deal? You still had cash. There's definitely some cases where let's continue to try to make this thing work. I think 24, there'll probably be a pickup of, all right, we kind of have to sell now. That would be my guess.
We got to bite the bullet.
I don't know in terms of dollar amount, because some of these companies will be running out of cash. They're sort of acquihires. So the dollar amount may not be that much higher, but I feel like the count, I would expect it to be higher in 24 than it was in 23 and 22. That would be my guess.
I think so too. And it's, you know, the kinds of companies that are getting acquired, obviously the later stage you go, the more difficult an acquisition becomes, both because of regulatory reasons, but also just like there's fewer buyers that can buy really, really big late stage companies. So the most common one is about 30% of the companies that are acquired on Carta every year are acquired after their Series A. So between Series A and Series B, seems to be like a sweet spot of real enough business, but also not too big that it's really difficult to, you know, digest for a bigger tech company or a private equity firm or things like that. So that seems to be the sweet spot.
Yeah, and I was going to say that's actually a question from John at RBC, our mutual friend. He wanted to know, what is the most common time for a company to get acquired, or what was the most frequent prior financing round? Is it Series A?
Yeah, it's Series A. I mean, it's a little tricky in that there's, you know, a number of acquisitions that happen that are sort of in the pre-seed space. You probably would term them acqui-hires. Kind of difficult to know the reasoning behind that. But if you look across acquisition timing, so in 2023, about 27% of the companies acquired were acquired after their Series A, another 20, 22% after their seed round. So that early part of the market is fairly acquisitive.
Roughly half, like just below half.
Yeah, just below half or so that are going to get acquired like in that seed Series A range. And then if they haven't raised the price round, there's a number of acquisitions there too. But again, those are probably mostly just like, hey, I think this team is really great, or I love this as a feature.
Yeah, and I think surprisingly, those can actually be better financial outcomes for founders or for early stage investors. And I guess I'll just kind of walk through the scenario is like, let's say your company was acquired for $50 million. You've raised a total of 10 total. Usually there's this thing called a liquidation preference. It just says there's usually a number attached to it. So a 1x liquidation preference, very roughly speaking, if there's an exit event, the investor who holds those, or the shareholder that owns that share with the liquidation preference, they get their money back before anyone else gets money. So they kind of sit at the top of the distribution of capital. So if your company is acquired for $50 million, there's 10 where they get their 1x return no matter what. And then the 40 is split. There's different ways it flows based on share classes and all that kind of stuff. But everyone can make money in that kind of situation. Now, let's say you were acquired for $50 million, but you raised $50 million, or you raised $100 million, and someone with a 1x liquidation preference sits at the very top. Let's say you raised $100 and you sold for $50. They don't even get their 1x return when that $50 million is distributed. So everyone below them gets zero. So you might say, like, we raised our Series B and we were acquired, but less money actually went to the founders or the early investors than like the seed round that got acquired. It's a little bit counterintuitive.
It's not, you know, the bigger number on the headline is not always better depending on what the preferences are in the money that you've raised. A lot of times, you know, and that's why people get really frightened by things like 2 or 3x liquidation preferences, which state that the investor doesn't get their money back. They get twice their money or 3x their money before anybody else on the cap table sees a dollar. And so those provisions can be really, they can really tamp down the actual end value for founders and employees.
What did you see in the data on those types of rounds just over the last couple of years? How did those trend?
They were more common, as you can imagine, in 23, but I think that their prevalence is actually a little bit overstated. It's only about 8% of deals on Carta that have a liquidation preference over 1x. So it's still a very small minority of deals that have this. I will say that number jumps, or that percentage jumps quite a bit higher in bridge rounds. So some of those bridges are definitely like people kind of doing anything they can and agreeing to some fairly onerous terms in order to get money in the door and stay alive. But it happens. You know, I think Jason Lemkin from Saster has some really strong opinions about how actually liquidation preferences only, like, they don't really come into play that often. You're either going to go out of business or you're going to exit for $1 billion and everyone still makes money. You know, I think there's probably a messy middle there where it does come into play and a lot of founders earn less than they think. But I think on the liquidation preference side, the thing that's most challenging for me to look at is just how little employees understand about those kinds of things. Like, employees at a normal startup, they just see the fundraise amount and they see the valuation and they think, hey, this is awesome. I'm in the money. Like, let's do it. And they don't really realize, like, there's a lot less cash available to employees at the end bottom of that waterfall.
Yeah. So what are you seeing just in terms of compensation markets, like things that are interesting to employees here in your data?
Yeah. So in the report, we showed that a few things happened last year that were really interesting for employees. So first, on the hiring environment, startups across Carta hired about 268,000 people last year, which seems like a very big number. But when then you look to 2022 and they hired over 500,000 people. So hiring was cut basically in half from the year prior. And layoffs, if you take layoffs and departures, like people leaving by choice, and add those up, they actually totaled more than the new hires. So startups as an industry got smaller in 2023, which is the first time that's happened in the history of Carta for sure. And it just, like, all of the headlines or, you know, talk out there about investors and founders like getting more serious about headcount, making sure they're managing payroll really closely, like that's 100% true. This was the year of headcount reductions. So that's first, like hiring was way down. Two, employees were, salary compensation didn't grow very much, but it didn't fall very much either. I think it was up about 0.5% or so on average. So not keeping pace with inflation, but at least it's not falling. Equity compensation over 2023 fell by a quarter or maybe even more. So and that's not just because the companies were valued less highly. So if you think of it as a pie, like each individual person was receiving a smaller slice of pie and that total pie was worth less. So it's both sides happening to employees. So equity comp was really down and employees responded, as you would expect them to in this sort of environment, by just saying, I'm not going to exercise my options. So when I leave this company, either through layoff or because I got a better job somewhere, you have that 90-day period typically to exercise your options and make them real stock. And only about 23% of employees are actually doing that, which is a bearish signal from employees about the future value of these companies.
And that is cut in half. I think it was 46% in Q4 of 21. So exactly 24 months prior.
Yep, exactly. And like you would expect that like exercise rate to be pretty cyclical. Like if you're on a rocket ship, you're much more likely to exercise than if you're looking around the headlines and you're like, oh, my company did a down round. But it's wrapped up. It's so deeply part of the promise of startups is that you have this upside bet. So we want employees to at least be thinking, hey, it's worth taking that chance. And they're just, they're choosing not to.
And I saw that repricing of options was also up like 3 to 5x over, 2 years ago, or maybe historical averages. What does that mean exactly? Just not actually 100% sure if I know what's going on there, but also for the audience.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a complex thing. It's actually a good thing. So state that up front. So a repricing happens. Let's say you and I are founders of a company, Turner, and we look around and we say, look, we think we need to take a down round. We got overvalued in 2021. What might happen then is that the value of the equity that we gave out to employees that we hired in 2022, say, is actually below the new valuation that we're taking on for that down round.
You mean above or below?
Below. So like the 409A valuation of the employee stock is above the new valuation for that round. So it's there's no upside left in this. Like, I'm underwater on my options. So what can happen then is founders, and this is not required, you know, so this is actually a good move by a lot of founders and boards. They can say, look, we still believe in this company and we believe in these hires. We want to take their 409A valuation and lower it to whatever the new 409A valuation is so that they have upside remaining in the business. And they do that by retiring the old options, usually, and issuing new ones. There's a lot of like board dynamics that goes into this. But effectively repricing is founders and boards giving employees more upside in their equity. So it's not required, but it is pretty cool to see when people really believe like, hey, my employee population should remain incentivized in this company. And yeah, it's more frequent than it used to be. Most of that is happening at the late stage. Not a lot of repricing in seed or series A stock, but good to see that founders are taking that very seriously too.
Yeah, I think it's probably easy to see the headline layoff numbers and think these are capitalists, don't care about people or whatever. But I mean, at least this is a sense of, okay, well, they're trying to do something. They are trying, like they're trying to keep the company alive. And they're also trying to do as well as they can, or treat their employees as well as they can. Actually, a question from Samuel Shah, prior guest of the show. He wondered if you're seeing anything in secondary activity.
Yeah, so when we look across secondaries that are happening, not through Carta, but we know about them because at the end of the day, when a secondary happens, like things change on the cap table. So we can have an aggregated, anonymized view of that. Secondaries were, the activity level was pretty down last year, which is almost like usually secondaries happen after a primary round. So fewer primary rounds means fewer secondary trades. There's a lot of interest in secondaries. You know, can you snap up these brand name companies for...
at a discount.
At a discount. But usually at the moment, what we're seeing is that buyers and sellers are still pretty far apart. The buyers are interested, but the sellers are still kind of anchored on that higher valuation and they're not willing to give up the stock or the options quite yet. I think that'll pick up once, you know, the valuations continue to turn around. The other type of secondary activity that happens is fund secondaries, where investors are actually selling positions in the fund. That I don't have a lot of data on, but we've heard anecdotally that's more active than it used to be. So a lot of like, how do you trade private market positions happening? It's a completely opaque and nobody really knows what's going on kind of market.
And that can be an interesting way to get an exposure to a company. Like, let's just say there's breakout ABC company, hottest AI company, everyone wants it. Super hard to get access to shares, but this banana capital fund that sucks, but they have this one position in ABC company. You're basically just buying. If you buy a stake in the fund, you're basically getting that one position. Like that, there's a little bit of that element potentially too on the early stage funds.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like, how do we get into the winners? You know, I can do that directly, or I can do that through a fund that's already invested in those winners. Like, but that's the end goal most of the time.
Yeah. Cause that's usually how someone's underwriting these. Like if they were looking at a fund, like, all right, what are like the two companies in here that are actually working? And the other ones are maybe call options. They might work, but we're basically saying, all right, they're a seed fund. They have one company. It's a Series C stage. It is pretty clearly working. That's basically what we're prescribing the entire value of our new position. Like we're buying it based on what is that? What results are we going to get from that one single portfolio company, which is maybe counterintuitive because it's a portfolio, but I mean, usually in the secondary markets, you're thinking about like downside, you're getting a deal, you're usually controlling that entry price where I think the good secondary buyers are usually, they're acting with leverage, like they're waiting where the market's in their favor. So at a time like now where people need liquidity, you can usually get a bigger discount because that's what you can control. You can't control the exit, but you can control where you come in at.
Yep. And to the point about liquidity, you know, if you need DPI, if you need to show some or return some cash to investors in order to start fundraising and things, like maybe that's more attractive to you than holding on to this winner that you have. Like where people exit, it's a really interesting like whole other hour and a half of like what's going on in venture and how people think about exits and all that kind of stuff. Because it has been investor early, hold till the IPO. Maybe people will try to get off that train a little bit earlier in some places.
Yeah. So is there one or maybe multiple interesting data points that you've seen like historically, your entire time looking at all the data on the platform, what are the most surprising data points that have just stuck out to you? And these can be literally anything.
I mean, there's a lot of different ways to take this. I think there are probably two interesting data points for early stage founders. One of the things that we found is that, you know, we did this study of about 7,500 companies on Carta, and we looked at how co-founders split their equity before any financing, before any employees. It's just like you and your co-founder in a room talking about who owns what in this company. The standard advice usually proffered by YC in many cases is split equally. You know, 50-50 is the right thing to do. You're going to be building this business for a decade. And that's great advice. You know, that's a wonderful way to do the business. What we found when we did the study, though, is that most founders don't do that. Only about 62% of two-founder companies did not split equally. So only about 40% did. And then you can imagine, as you get to founders that are three founders, four founders, five founders, like, it's actually quite rare to split a five-founder company 2020. Like, that doesn't happen very often. So, like, investigating those choices was really cool, and, like, seeing how founder equity dynamics play out when the founders are starting this company together versus when maybe a founder comes in a year after the company has started and joins as a co-founder. Like, I found all that, like, early decision-making stuff really, really fascinating.
Yeah. Interesting, you know, anecdote on that. I've seen two people start a company together. 6 months later, one co-founder leaves. They go from like 50-50 or 60-40 down to 95-5 or something like that. And then the new co-founder that comes in gets, you know, like a year later gets like 20%. So then it's like the exited co-founder that, you know, helped get things started. Maybe they, the first engineer or something, they own 5%. And then the new co-founder, 20-25-30, something like that. And then the other co-founder that's kind of been there the whole time has 60-70, whatever my numbers add up to, something like that. So that's an interesting one that I've seen too, which in the sense of how it can split, just based on timing of when they also joined.
And that's to, like, the underlying point there is have a vesting schedule on those shares. You know, you don't want to go through a co-founder divorce and then come out of it and say, well, you know, we split this thing 50-50, but now it's a year in and you own your full 50% and I own my full 50%. And there's no mechanism to get that 50% back except for talking to this person that you've obviously had some difficulty with. That's a really tough place to be. So founders on the call, like, put vesting schedules on everybody's equity, founders included.
I've seen it kill businesses too, where they didn't do that. It's 50-50, one person leaves, and effectively half of the cap table is dead. You can't, that second founder is no longer involved. So typically in an ideal world, all the cap table is working, trying to make things happen. And when you suddenly cut off 50% of it, it's just so hard to attract new investors because they'll see that and be like, who's this person that is not involved that owns half the business? So sometimes what I'll see is just like in a best case scenario, the founder that leaves, if they didn't have things vested, they will kind of give some shares back or something, or maybe they'll sell them to the business back at a discount. Maybe like that's potentially what can happen. But ultimately, like, if you don't fix that, it can just kill the business. So you say, I still want to own 50% of this thing that I worked on. Well, if that's not worth anything in the future, it doesn't matter how much you own. So I think it's worth going through the exercise of being like, I'm okay giving up a lot of this in the sense of it will still be worth something in the future because I gave up certain percentage. Like, you want to maximize your potential for that to actually, you know, materialize, because it probably won't.
Yes. It's, you're already working with small probabilities anyways. So you got to kind of base a lot of decisions on that. But dead equity is a major reason why some businesses can't receive funding, because VCs look at it and say, look, there's not enough left for both the future investors and for you, the founder. Like, you're just not incentivized highly enough to keep moving.
Yeah. And sometimes what'll happen later on in a company's life, they'll, whether it's a bridge round or it's like a pay to play down round, whatever, you can restructure the cap table. You can just say, all the existing investors, if you don't participate in this round, the class of shares are going to change. So there's kind of ways to get around it that are a little bit less exciting to talk about, but there's ways that you can influence, change the cap table a little bit. So in terms of, you know, we're talking about like debt equity, managing all these like weird cap table situations, I think you've mentioned in the past really interesting data point, 2023, most shutdowns ever that you've ever seen in the history of Carta platform. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's unfortunate, but just, you know, fact of life, there are a lot of businesses just didn't make it out of 2023. About, I think it was close to 1,000 in the end that shut down across Carta last year for, you know, bankruptcy, dissolution. There's a lot of different ways to term it, but basically, you know, closing up shop as a startup.
How many total startup customers does Carta have, or what percentage of the customers shut down?
Yeah, we're at about 43,000 companies on the platform now. So as a percentage, it's not that high. It's a little difficult to do those percentage maths though, because of the different stages. So one of the ways that I would illustrate like how difficult it was last year is if you just take startups that had already raised 10 million bucks, these are not idea stage startups. These are companies that have raised significant amount of capital. Shutdowns were about 2.5 times more than they were in the prior year. So even companies who'd raised significant cash and were like real businesses were also shutting down. So it was just a really difficult year for that. And I think one of the ways, or one of the difficulties that founders have, is that the shutdowns are happening at the same time as all of these major AI rounds are being raised, or especially this coming year, I expect fundraising to get better, but I also expect a lot of companies to shut down. And so this, like, it's going to feel very sort of bipolar or dichotomous depending on where you sit in the venture ecosystem.
Yeah, it's kind of like the ebbs and flows, different segments of the market diving down. So then when you just mentioned something I know we were going to talk about, you think it's going to get better in 2024. What are you seeing to make you think that?
Maybe I'm just like naively optimistic. A couple things. So one, December was a good month for fundraising. I think that Q1 has started off pretty good as well in terms of startup fundraising. Again, to your point earlier, it's not super useful for us to always compare to 2021 and say, this is where we need to get back to. It may be the case that we don't get back to that level of funding for more than a few years yet, and that's okay. But we are rising, I think rising up. Valuations seem to be rising pretty steadily, especially at the early stages. So that's all positive. And then the other sort of prediction that I would have is, or I guess it's less of a prediction and more of just the really open question is, okay, all these companies that are starting or started last year or starting right now, will they be able to grow faster with less headcount and higher revenues more quickly than any companies we've seen before? And how does that change venture? You know, I'm super fascinated by the idea that a company can take in 1 to 2 million bucks in funding, keep the team really small and use AI to automate some things and then explode, you know, Midjourney and other places maybe as examples of this. I think a lot of companies are going to try it. And I'm fascinated to see whether or not you can get a lot of venture scale outcomes without a lot of venture money. That would change the whole landscape of venture capital. We may not see all of that come to fruition in 24, but we're definitely going to see a lot of companies try it.
Yeah. When you think about the dry powder that's out there, a good chunk of it is not inception stage pre-seed dollars. I mean, that's like 5-10% of the capital. Majority of the capital is later-ish stages. So when you say there's this new trend of not raising the later-ish stages for high double digits, almost 3-digit, you know, you were talking like 80-90% of the capital is not going to be able to be deployed into this. That's an interesting supply and demand function of where does that all end up?
My instinct is that everyone's talking about, you know, the Sam Altman thing of there's going to be a $1 billion company run by one person. That's cool for Sam, you know, kudos to him. He's got the right to say that. My gut is that as things sort of get healthier, people will do what we usually do and say, hey, funding's actually good. Like, let's turn back to the boom times. If it's the case that founders really are that laser focused on capital efficiency and want to keep things really small and not raise a lot of money, like, where does that mid-growth VC capital go? I think is a fascinating question.
Where do you think it will go if you had to give a take?
My best guess is that the deals will get so competitive that there'll just be more capital invested into fewer companies at really, really high valuations or rounds. Like, if you're sitting on, if you have a $600 or $700 million fund and you're writing $5 or $10 million checks and like no one's taking your check because they say, we don't need to fundraise, maybe you expand that to a $20 million check and say like, well, would you turn down $20 million? Like, what could you do with this? I don't know. I think it's, my gut is that it won't actually, you know, not a lot of businesses are going to be able to do this without real significant funding, but maybe I'm wrong and AI will change everything.
Yeah, I think it just generally compresses returns. If you have valuations going up, returns compress, which then less capital flows into the space, harder to fundraise, et cetera. I feel like people are, I feel like this whole we're not going to raise thing is just like a, it's like a, like a teenage phase where you're like, I don't want to talk to my parents. Like, I think it's going to, I totally respect it. And I think it's a great way to run a business. I just feel like eventually you're going to get a deal that you're just like, man, we can move so much faster, hire so many more really talented people. And the outcome will actually be greater, faster, if I take this venture money. And I mean, the thing no one talks about is how amazing and incredible the venture capital, like content marketing, like industrial complex is of just convincing people that you need to take their money. It's an incredible flywheel, like just the things that they do.
It's probably the best example of content marketing that I find across the internet these days is just like how deeply embedded the idea of venture capital is for quote unquote startup founders. I think also some of it comes from the fact that the word lifestyle business kind of sucks.
Yes, it's so derogatory.
Like, yeah, just call it like cool, like small entrepreneurship. I don't know. There's got to be a better name for that because right now it's so derogatory and that's not cool. Like those businesses are fantastic. They just don't have venture capital.
Your lifestyle business that's only worth $100 million. Like that's so gross. It's like, come on.
It's like a B2B SaaS tech business that's worth, yeah, $100, $200 million, and you're just kind of poo-pooing it on the side. It's like, yeah, but you didn't grow 100% last year, so we're not interested.
Yeah, it's, I mean, the incentives are to deploy capital. That is the incentive of the VC, you know, industry. It's raising money and deploying capital. It's really not generating returns. So, you know, it skews towards trying to incentivize people to take their money, really, at the end of the day. So I'm trying to think of anything else interesting on like the future of venture. I think the safe thing is kind of an interesting proposition that you kind of talked about is like, will we need a new form of early stage financing if we are not raising as much later on, like how the safe kind of evolves. That's an interesting development to watch.
Yeah. Maybe we see a return slightly to a convertible note, which at least because it has the interest rate and the maturity date, like it forces the conversation. There's like a conversion mechanism there. I still think the safe is going to be default how a lot of fundraising happens. The other maybe like not prediction, but interesting idea here is there's always talk on Twitter and other places about, you know, where's the best place to start a business or which venture ecosystem wins. And to date, that has always been Silicon Valley. And I don't think there's a lot of data that point to something other than Silicon Valley winning, especially with AI being so focused on San Francisco. But what I am interested in is like you effectively, the rates for safes, the valuation caps and other things are starting to normalize across the country. So you're actually not getting as much of an arbitrage if you're a Midwest investor as you used to, or a East Coast investor as you used to when you compare it to West Coast places. There are fewer companies, but like, they're raising pretty healthy amounts on safes at pretty decent valuation caps. So at the national market for early startups is slowly converging.
I think I've always run into this thing personally where if somebody says they're like a geographic based investor and they like invest in the best startups and we'll say Texas or something, or we'll say Arizona. I don't know. Nothing against these markets at all. I don't even know if this is true, but if there's, I'm sure there's funds focused there, but let's just say you're the best startup in Arizona. Who's to say you might not raise money from a Sequoia or a Founders Fund or, you know, insert whatever fund that's based in the coasts. Like, I mean, I think the interesting thing that happens there is the cream will kind of always rise to the top, if that makes sense. And then to your point about valuations rising, everybody use comps. So like, let's say we're Midwest, the average valuation is $3 million for the very first round. But you're Peter Walker, this amazing founder, you raise from a West Coast investor and you raise at $10 million and you're based in Arizona. And then another founder in Arizona says, well,
Peter got 10,
like maybe I could do five. And then that becomes a new standard. And then someone else says 15. And then you say, okay, well, why can't we do eight? Right? Like that just seems reasonable. And then suddenly you go from it being three to be being eight is the market average. And then to your point of San Francisco, it's okay, well, San Francisco will say is 9 or 10. Suddenly there's no difference really at the end of the day.
Yeah. And that's, I think that is dynamic is definitely happening across the US. There are still regional differences. I don't want to paint this as a completely national picture. But the other like cool ecosystem thing that I'm curious about and watching is just like the density of angels in a specific place. It's like how many people in that place of the rich individuals that live in Dallas or Houston or Tempe, Arizona, like what percentage of them invest that disposable income in startups versus the market or real estate or whatever? Like that, I think, is a really cool indicator of how entrenched VC, like startup culture is in a place. Like in, you know, you walk around San Francisco, feels like everyone's an angel investor. Whereas you walk around, you know, Phoenix and it probably doesn't feel that way. I think that is cool. And you're starting to see it increase in places like Austin and other places that have really like sort of taken off as VC markets over the past few years.
Are you able to see any kind of recycle of capital? Like, do you see that in your data where it's like, oh, we're seeing exits in Austin and we're also seeing more angel activity in Austin?
We would maybe be able to correlate it. We wouldn't be able to say like this person did this specific thing. Funnily enough, though, I was talking with an investor the other day and he was saying that basically the way that he termed it is the whole nation of Australia is waiting for Canva to go public. That will be like the biggest recycle moment for the country as a whole. So like, yeah, people definitely are betting on the idea that more exits means angels do well and then they go back and recycle that capital into new businesses.
So another way to think about these like emerging hubs is we'll say like Boise, Idaho, Tempe, Arizona, Detroit, Michigan. What is the expectation of some of those angel investors? Like, are they people who say we're in this for 15 years or are we trying to get a 2x return in 3 years kind of a thing? I think that kind of influences how a hub will evolve too. So to your point on Austin or to your point on Australia, the type of capital that is being recycled and being put back in, I think if it's a startup founder or startup employee versus a real estate investor or a lawyer or a doctor, I just feel like they did generally have different return expectations and how they approach angel or early stage investing too.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I guess the question there is, will Silicon Valley sort of educate everyone else to the boom bust model that we've sort of defaulted to? You know, it needs to 10 or 100x at this stage or it's not worth it. Or will the rest of the country, as more people get involved in this part of investing, like kind of change the model and say, hey, actually, you know, 3x, 4x is pretty good. Like we should figure out a way to recycle capital faster. The venture capital, the way it works in San Francisco is wonderful and it creates these immense outcomes. But it does leave a lot of companies on the wayside that probably could be pretty good businesses. They just took VC and they had to grow at a super high rate. So maybe there's a better, more healthy middle where there's like an off ramp from venture for some of these companies that are good companies. They're just not going to grow 300% a year.
Yeah, I think it's you have to have large pools of capital waiting with the right return expectations, because you can't just say, because like the entire venture industry is set up on power laws, massive outcomes. You can't just say, hey, in your fund that's set up for that, do you want to do a couple of these single doubles instead of grand slams? Like you have to have the whole portfolio set up to try to fund grand slams. So you almost need like new pools of capital raise to say, hey, we are offloading. We are helping you ramp off. We're only trying to hit singles. We're trying to get a 20% return on every single investment, because you can't have half of your venture fund say we're trying to hit singles and then you don't hit any grand slams and you have half your portfolio that's literally goes to zero and then half that's like singles and you barely return any of the capital to LPs. Like LPs won't invest in that. The ecosystem will die.
Fund by fund, you can't like switch strategies in the middle of the fund and be like, oh, we're cool with 2x for everybody. Definitely not. But could you build, you know, there are some interesting investors or interesting players in the venture market who are saying things like, you know, I know of one fund that all they do is they kind of review all of the seed and Series A transactions going on, and then they just take other funds pro rata at the B. So they say like, oh, I think you're cool. You're a good investor. You can exit now and you keep focusing on the early part of the market, which you seem to be fantastic at. And then we'll take the capital from B onward and sort of like do that baton handoff. Maybe that's a way to structure things that is kind of gets recycled capital a little quicker. Because on the recycled capital point, startups are staying private for a dozen years, 14 years. Like these, if you're trying to make it to IPO, that's a huge amount of time to have your capital tied up.
Yeah, I feel like the tricky part, I mean, I mentioned this a couple of times. The tricky part is like, you've got to make sure you get those big outcomes though. Like if you get out of the big outcome too early, it breaks the venture model. So you definitely have to balance of like making sure you're taking your liquidity at the right point that matches the venture capital asset class.
I mean, that's why they pay you the 2 and 20, right?
Yeah, the 20 and 20. Well, yeah, because I think we've had an interesting point with a couple of portfolio companies where like they're trying to get some early investors to sell secondary in like a hot round. And, you know, you invest the risk capital early on. It's not clear it's going to work. It finally starts to work. And then you get out like, and you take it like, that's kind of not, it just kind of breaks them all. You got to like continue to see the fruits of taking the risk early on. That's kind of the point of venture capital. So it's super fascinating. I mean, there's so many different ways to do this and how to run a fund, how to make your decisions. So
totally. Yeah. Those are the really tough decisions for GPs out there, is like, how do we make money on this, but also remain super long-term incentivized with the founders to hit the IPO market.
Well, this has been an awesome conversation. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
And I think we'll throw a link to the Carta kind of data insight newsletter in the show notes, but quick plug for that. What would you plug?
Yeah. So it's called the Data Minute. We release one newsletter every week on Thursday mornings, one chart about something within those 43,000 companies that's interesting or fun. So if you like data or insights on startups, I think you'll find it really useful.
Awesome. And I think, yeah, this entire conversation was structured around data that you put out in those newsletters. So awesome. Well, this is great. Thanks again.
Yeah. Cheers. Thanks, Turner.
And thank you for listening. If you don't want to miss future episodes of The Peel, subscribe to my newsletter, The Split, in the show notes, and you'll get new episodes plus transcripts in your inbox every week. If you want to support the show, share this episode with a friend who likes startup data. If you want to go deeper on all these topics, make sure to check out Peter's newsletter in the show notes. And if you want to upgrade your CRM, tap that link to check out everything Atio has to offer. Thanks again for listening. I hope you enjoyed. See you in the next episode.